Hello, this is Pearl Land Podcast. I'm very happy today. I'm in London now. I'm sitting here with Philip Colbert and in his splendid, amazing studio, looking at all the lobsters. And Philip, since a lot of people who's watching this or listening to this podcast, they are not necessarily in the art world. So will you give a very brief bio of yourself?
Bio or introduction. Yes, lovely to have you back in the studio, Pearl. So a lot of people know me as the Lobster because that's my like creative persona. I'm an artist and I'm based here in London. I'm originally from Scotland and I studied philosophy, which was, I think, the first like big, aside from very poignant connections with lobsters at the seaside when I was a very small kid, it was probably the first step. Studying philosophy was like probably the most significant, I guess, influence of my artistic career in terms of, I was obsessed with Friedrich Nietzsche and Hegel and Schopenhauer and these 19th century philosophers. And that had a big impact on my thinking about the world and thinking about art. And I was always obsessed with art since a small kid, but it took me a while to actually become an artist, let's say, vocationally.
Let's start from the very beginning.
Yeah.
A Scottish boy, graduated from University of Edinburgh.
St. Andrews.
St. Andrews, sorry.
Next to Edinburgh.
How did you have the dream of coming to London? Was it planned for you to come to London?
No, it wasn't really planned for me. I think, you know, I was pretty spaced out as a kid. And I think that luckily coming across a book, Human All Too Human by Friedrich Nietzsche, when I was like pretty high as a sort of 16-year-old or something, was probably quite an important thing for me. Because I think otherwise I was very spaced and I wasn't very engaged. And I could have easily just ended up working in a shop in a small town in Scotland or doing something like super random. So in a way, that was quite an important part of like me switching my brain on a little, because I think it was an agency. I think reading philosophy books, reading Nietzsche, for example, inspired me because it gave me an agency about my own identity and my own, the malleability of my own identity.
Nietzsche influenced a lot of artists, musician, artists, composer.
Because Nietzsche wrote with passion. It's like thinking with passion. And I think that's what's so inspiring. It's very poetical and very passionate. And I think it's a bit like I was also obsessed with Nirvana, for example, when I was a teenager as well. Like I was obsessed with Kurt Cobain and grunge and like all this stuff. So I went through the different periods, as all most teenagers do. You go different periods. Like music was a big thing, and the musicians and everything. And I think like for me, Friedrich Nietzsche was like, I guess I would always been a bit disillusioned at school with like the hierarchy of teachers and authority and like the conveyor belt of like being packaged and put down the conveyor belt. So I was pretty like anti it, but rather than doing anything about that or saying anything, I was just like switching off. And the problem when you just switch off is then you just get packaged and sent down the conveyor belt.
Of course.
But you're not even aware and you just let it happen. And I think like the reading philosophy really gave me the agency to sort of wake up to realize actually the one, your identity is something you're in control of and you can actually change or you can play with it. If you're not happy how you're being presented or pushed down the line, you can change it.
At the age of 16, 17, 18 at that age, you already think
Well,
like
those
that?
Are the key formative years where you're like, you know, and especially also at schools, they're like quite...
You're pretty mature.
No, I think I was luckily just more of an outsider kid, you know, so I had that freedom of time.
You're not self-indulgence at all.
No, well, I think I guess I had a bit of time to think, yeah.
But you are very well versed in history of art.
Yeah, well, I love the language of art. It's what I obsess with. It's my obsession. And so I'm very lucky to be working in this realm, which I'm passionate about.
You know, we are talking about today popular art, pop artist. I mean, you are right in the center of this phenomenon, actually, because pop artists has always been having a problem that, you know, the institution, they're actually pushing, we don't want pop artists, we want artists who's very intellectual, who's very academic, with conceptual. Do you feel that you're being discriminated?
No, Definitely not. I don't think that. I think that, you know, in society, there's always going to be changing fashions, and there's always going to be things that are, you know, the establishment promote or like or don't like. And I think that can change. But I think also the role of the artist is slightly, you know, the different artists do different things, and that's great. You know, there's no like one philosophy for everyone. Like, I happen to be someone that really believes in the spirit of art for everyone. And also, I'm very anti-pretension. So for the very essence of me, I'm quite anti this sort of hierarchy of taste and judgment.
Absolutely, in a way, hierarchy of art form is a little bit.
So for me, like in a way, I'm totally cool with not necessarily being championed by the hierarchy of the establishment, because that's never been my thing, not what I'm necessarily interested in. I'm much more interested in making art and just communicating to people and doing that in creative ways. And I think for me, like, the freedom of art to explore different mediums, and whether it's multimedia with like animations or cartoons or the metaverse projects or sculptures or city takeovers, they're all ways of like reaching new audience and like pushing my work in new dimensions, and in a way like collectively changing the phenomenon of what the art is. Because I think, you know, art exists as an artist, you make works in different dimensions. Like, most artists today make works, and like whether it's sculpture or painting or some digital things,
or even just
the way they talk about the work. Because the artist, obviously, the relationship between the artist and the work is also very important. So there's a performative aspect to everyone's work, which is just what they've got to say about it, the stories they tell. Like, ultimately, art is the collectivity of the objects, of the sort of relics of the story.
So then, what pushed you to come to London instead of staying in Scotland?
Well, I think it wasn't like a grand plan or anything. It was just like, after graduating, it was the obvious place to get to try and get a job. Or so for me, it was like, at that stage, it was like, well, I didn't know much about the art world. I knew in my head that one day I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't quite know how to do that. And so initially then, I created a clothing label because I thought,
I was very
inspired by Diaghilev and Ballet Russe and all this stuff. And I was quite into the concept of like that would be something like, you know, selling a T-shirt or something is an easier way of making, you know, making money or making a living than selling a painting. So I didn't know how to do that. So I set out doing that, and then quickly it sort of evolved into making like wearable artworks and going a bit more experimental. And I had this sort of concept-y band, and I was rapping.
So our first thing is, if you do a clothing line, a fashion line, and so on, you must be a very good sales. Because you must have an idea of how to do marketing, packaging, and then to sell.
Well, I think there's no choice. I mean, I think it's if you want to do that as your vocation, then you've got no choice. I mean, it's like you either make it fly.
I know
or
a
you
lot
don't.
Of fashion designer.
Yeah, they, but no, it's very hard. Like, fashion is very hard.
They can't sell. They are fantastic, but they can't outsell.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it was very difficult, and I think, but it was a hustle, and I think, you know, that was hard. But I think, like anything, you work at it, and it, you know, it work leads to things. So I think it.
So after that, what was the next step, and how did you evolve to establish an artist career?
Yeah, so I started collaborating with brands, you know, like Snoopy or, you know, these, you know, Disney and these type of, you know, established IP brands that liked what I was doing and were like, oh, will you use some of our characters or reinvent them a little bit? And so that was financially helpful, because these brands would have money to, and they would pay me to do stuff with the, you know, to make things with their IP stuff. And that, like, gave me support in the sense I was able to then play around and make collections of bags or crazy outfits with these collaborative projects.
But it's really funny, you know. Traditionally, all those collaborations are being frowned at in the fine art world. And today, I mean, artist needs collaboration to make artists a brand, depending on what sort of artist you want to be. I mean, if you're a popular artist, you want an artist brand to collaborating to put you on the map. So did you enjoy these collaboration? Besides, you were making money for survival.
Yeah, you know, I love the spirit of collaboration. I do a lot of it today. Like, I think that's something I learned in the early days, that the power of collaboration and the power of reaching a different audience and like expanding one's medium, because it just like makes, you know, reaches more people. And I think like now I've got like quite a few different collaborations coming out at the moment, some new ones, but definitely worked with quite a lot over the years. And we've just got next month the Johnnie Walker whiskey collaboration of all the bottles and packaging and everything with some little sculpture collectibles across China and Taiwan. And then I've got a collaboration coming out in Korea. There's a lot of new things happening.
When you first started, have you already have this lobster alter eagle in your mind?
No, it sort of evolved. As I was building my vocabulary of language, like symbols, I was always really into pop culture symbols, a bit like Egyptian hieroglyphics. It was like the power of the symbol to jump across the street and catch someone's attention. And if you've got a second of someone's attention, like you want to, you know, hit them with a sort of like an icon, something that profoundly means something, but it's also infinitely accessible. So I was always interested in this balance between of meaning within symbols. And so I would gravitate to symbols I found bold, fun, but yet meaningful. And the lobster was one of those symbols that I really liked because of the surrealism and mortality connotation. Like the Dali-esque, like the protagonist almost of surrealism. I felt the lobster was like a caricature of the spirit of surrealism. So as a symbol, just having that symbol channeled that idea. And so,
but your lobster is incredibly cute.
So, well, this
very
is the symbol.
Very different.
See,
from
this is how
surrealism.
It started. See, the little symbol of the lobster is what I used to, like doodles of this I would wear and I would have suits or blah, blah, blah. Like, and people started calling me Lobster Man. So that was having the symbol. And then I really became Lobster Man. So it started with a T-shirt and then ended up with a shirt.
Oh, wonderful. And then later on, it's on the canvas.
Yeah, then on canvas. So that was really when I started really identifying as a lobster. When I was like, oh my God, I am a lobster. It was probably, so the epiphany moment probably came in like 2017 when I was like going to start painting again. And I was like, got myself a studio. And then I was like, well, facing this idea of like painting, making paintings, but also like representing me in painting. And I was like, well, I've already sort of got an identity. People sort of call me Lobster Man already because I've always got the lobster symbol. And so I was thinking about my identity and I was thinking about how, you know, the sort of mask we wear of what we do and what we, and I think artists, you make the stuff and you put it out there and that becomes a form of your identity. It becomes your, you know, how people perceive you.
Yeah.
It's your projected identity. And I think I'd already created in a way this identity. So I was like, well, you know what, it's obvious. It's already there. I'm just going to embrace it and you know, channel that and evolve it really. And that's when I painted myself really as a more figurative lobster character in an interior scene. And then I was like, okay, well, that then led to more narrative where the lobster character was doing different things. And in the early days, it was very much like the character was like myself was often battling the sea of information and references, which I think was my representation of my brain, like the realism of my experience of life at that point, like all the historical theory I was interested in, but the crazy submersion of emojis and like, you know, hyper stimulation that, you know, just the hyper scroll and this sort of idea of a pop landscape today, you know, like rather than being a sort of idealized like billboard Wesselman, it's actually a hyper pop, hyper stimulation. And it's everything all at once, you know, for everyone sort of thing.
I mean, to let the audience to know is Philip does not eat seafood. Once I was serving lobster when he came to
you
my
always
house
take
after
the,
dinner,
yeah.
He nearly freaked out.
You know, I thought you were just trying to finish me off. It was a deliberate, cynical attempt to kill Lobster Man, to invite him to a lobster dinner.
To a lobster dinner. So
everyone would eat me. And it reminds me of that kid's book, Lenny the Lobster, the way it comes for dinner.
But what amazes me is you take the lobster character and you develop into metaphors. It's called Lobsterpolis, right?
Yeah.
The Lobsterpolis. And you develop into completely the world, the metaphors, the world of the lobster. How are you seeing digital art? I mean, how are you going to build I mean, I see you building the lobster into the digital art.
Yeah.
What is your confidence or how digital art is going to evolve?
Yeah, well, for me, the digital medium is really the medium of our time in terms of...
Yes, of course.
We've seen the evolution of that.
You cannot deny that.
That's obvious. I mean, it's like beyond obvious. So in a way, that makes, you know, the dimension where art is really defining the age we're living in the most powerful in a way, because that's the language-changing, game-changing medium where things are evolving constantly and opportunities which would never have been possible before or possible. So, like, for me, that I was very interested in that. Obviously, it was a way I was, like, always experimenting with how to find new mediums and things. So, you know, the metaverse was, you know, virtual reality was at first the thing that I got into and started building Lobsteropolis and the Lobster Planet with as a virtual reality experience. I mean, I was always interested in the idea of, you know, an artist historically would present a painting as a vision of you, like a world, and that was like a magical window.
Mm.
And with technology, in a way, you can step into that window.
You just bring them to the contemporary world.
Well, yeah, you go beyond the window. You go into the world. The audience actually opens the door and goes in rather than just look out the window. So it's a real opportunity to immerse the audience fully in the artistic work experience. So I guess, like, I was very inspired by that initially. And then with the rise of the metaverse, this idea of a global space, like a digital, you know, dimension where people could experience art all over the world without having to have without going to a physical location was I find very interesting. So I built the Lobsteropolis city in Decentraland, which was the biggest like artist development, project.
But okay, you build this, but how are you marketing it to attract people to get into the Lobsteropolis? Because to build one is one thing, market is another thing. So as an artist, you built it. So are you having a marketing team to market it?
No. I mean, I think I was lucky that when I built Lobsteropolis, it happened to coincide with the boom of NFTs and the boom of the metaverse.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So just the very nature of having a large site within Decentraland at that period where it became very hot, suddenly gave it some value because it was just a big development, metaverse development. And I guess at that point also NFTs were very hot, and I launched my NFT project, the Lobstars.
Yeah, I know. Your NFT community project was very, very successful.
And in a way that automatically then just drew some interest and attention. We used the metaverse a lot as a platform for the NFT community, because I think that was really amazing with this NFT movement. It was also about art, it was about community, it was democratic, it was accessible.
But how about now? Well, the NFT market is so down.
Yeah, but
so what do you think, I mean...
Yeah, well, for me it was like...
Is your community still...
Yes, so I'm lucky that I do have very some really passionate community members all over the world. So like often my different shows, whether it's in Singapore or in China or Korea, like Japan, I'll always have community members coming to my shows.
Oh, that's, you know, wonderful.
Which is amazing. Like, so there's a really real aspect to it. And so I find that amazing. And it's actually, to be honest, even in Europe, anywhere I go in the world and have an exhibition, there will be 100% very passionate Lobstar community members. And I think that's an incredible, like,
incredible.
So it is actually a form of like a fan club in a way, people that are passionate about art and happen to really connect particularly with my work. And in a way, them being part of the community gives them access to things. And, you know, we have a whole, you know, system of products and merchandise that goes to the holders.
Yeah, that's
of my
what energy. I find out. I always find, Philip, you are very special. You're very current today's artist because you actually have the whole thing. You have the merchandising. You touch in different platforms. You have huge collaboration with different people. And then you do things that shock people, like Venice Biennale, that was 2 years ago, when you have a big lobster floating into the harbour. And you're very good in marketing as well. You know how to put yourself in the midst of the most important event. Like I went to Rome specially to see,
yes, you're very
see
kind,
your yeah. your sculpture lined along via what? Via
Veneto and yeah, Villa Borghese Park.
Yeah, Veneto.
Yes, via Veneto. Via
Veneto. All these things is, I haven't seen many artists who is able to create that.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm always, yeah, as I've been experimenting in these different things, I think definitely the feeling of the city takeovers using, you know, doing large inflatables or larger public sculptures and things, just an amazing way of taking the work out into the streets and having, yeah. And I guess luckily, because my work is quite accessible, having a character, an alter ego, does also make that easier, because it just, you know, it's something that can speak to a wide audience of people.
I just read about you that you are influenced by old master, and that put old master into contemporary culture. Explain more about that, please.
Well, I'm obsessed with the history of art, and I guess I'm also obsessed with historical painting, just because I'm really obsessed with art. Just like,
I see, you know, some of those are very...
Yes, and
I can see this.
And I guess... I was very interested in the structural device between these historic battle scenes. Because if you think of historical painting, the most elevated paintings are often stories, or, you know, great mythological stories.
I think you just like battles.
Yeah. No, well, I love storytelling. I think art is effectively, you know, the essence of art, the magic of art is the story. Otherwise, it's just matter, object, you know, meaningless matter. But what gives it value is the story.
Mm.
And that's the essence of art, is the story. And I think... like, historically, that was always very clear. You know, great. You think of the Renaissance painters; they were obsessed with revisiting antiquity and the lost works from Pompeii. Or, you know, there was always this desire to revisit also the high period of classic the classics. You know, with from the ancient Greeks to this. So there was always this interest in art to tell stories, and whether mythological, historical stories about battles, about culture.
Yes, but that is the old world. Remember, today's world, we were talking about conceptual paintings, which is a complete different thing from...
Not really.
...from telling stories and all
Well,
that.
It can, but yet the conceptual paintings fully require, more than anything, a story.
Stories, but really is about a philosophy behind it.
Yeah, but that's still a story. And also what I find interesting is, you take a philosophy, it's still a point of view.
Exactly.
So, and a battle is just two different points of view, you know. So a battle is also a structure to illustrate the tension between light and dark. I mean, why is Caravaggio so good? So it's the theatrical tension,
dramatic
lighting. It's, you know, the essence of historical art has always been that tension between light and dark, life and death. So I think this structural tension within battle composition, for me, has always been something. I find it an interesting device pictorially, because it puts forces against each other, and it's more about revealing the tensions within the aesthetics than necessarily talking about. I'm obviously not talking about any particular historical battle. I'm just using battle structure.
Yes, you do use battle structure. This is it. But then you are a great art collector as well. But whatever you collect is not battle.
I'd love to collect Rubens' battle scenes. They're just a little bit out of my price.
But yeah. I saw your other works with you, and you collected. It's completely very different from what you painted.
No, but not necessarily, actually, because I mean, if I could afford it, I would buy more of the artists that I'm very inspired by. But I do like buy bits and bobs of small, lesser works, like by Alexander Calder or Leger, works that have hugely influenced me as an artist. And I have like little bits and pieces by some of those guys. So in a way, those are things that are very visible within my artistic work, in a way, the influence. But, you know, it's just... Not the complete picture, but part of the picture.
Tell me more about you said that when you begin to make yourself make some money, you were doing collaboration. But how does these brands went and saw your work? You must be really good how to put your work.
I think you always, I've always had the philosophy that, you know, there's so much of everything today. So it's very important, like, in whatever you do, to like make an effort to be original and just not follow the queue, really, or draw on the line of doing. So it's always good to feel like not to follow the rules too much. Like, I think so. I think like always trying to like make a point of difference, to make your work stand out and have clear identity. And I think then people, that attracts people, because I think Like I've always, I guess, felt that, I mean, also just, you know, going out and about, like, I guess when I started, you know, you just go to other openings and you go out and about, and just being out and about, things happen. Whereas if you don't go out and about, so I think it's like, there's this balance of how much time we'd spend in the studio, but also like venturing out to things.
Of course,
like,
when, especially, you know, when you first begin, you want to meet everybody.
Yeah, so you sneak into parties. Yeah. Or, you know, it's like the most fun party is the one you're not invited to.
Of course, gay crashing.
Yeah, definitely the best way. Yeah.
So now, now you are supported by the art community as well. Well, so how are you feeling from freshly graduate, a person who doesn't really know how to become an artist, and now you're being supported by the art community?
I've got sort of one foot in the system and one foot out of the system. I think I'm sort of like
yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. So I always,
that makes
like,
you special.
Well, I think I feel comfortable like in that sort of situation, just because like I guess I like to try and exist across a few dimensions, just because I think there's a freedom in it. And I like, yeah, as we were talking about with collaboration, with like, I'm very lucky that I've been able to build an audience in Asia, which, you know, so many amazing countries where I've found amazing connection and support for my work. That, to be honest, I think if we go back to the critical point of my career, I think like actually traveling, it was 100% the success factor of like, taking my first painting exhibition was at Saatchi Gallery, and I was lucky that Charles Saatchi actually installed the exhibition and everything, and gave me this amazing space to do my first show. And from that, like, I had a Japanese dealer who'd actually been a big Basquiat dealer back in the 80s.
Oh, I know, Show.
Yes, exactly, Show, who came to the show. Show came to the show. And it was like, oh my God, Japan people will love this work.
Yeah,
I need to bring you to Japan. So actually, Show really was my first show. I got this first show in Japan. Maybe it was that invitation came in 2017. I think we had the exhibition early, the very beginning of 2018 or end of 2000. I can't quite remember, but it was around that period. And that was like my first foray into, and I just made my little lobster figure toy as well at that point. And at that point. It was an amazing thing, because it just having that one piece of good luck of getting an entry into an Asian market suddenly then opened three or four from that.
Yeah, because I remember in Singapore last year, Marina Sand Bay has all your sculptures as well.
Yes. So I guess it started a chain reaction of interest. I think it just happened, because that's, I would say to young artists, like, in a way, the great thing about traveling or like, you know, following opportunity is, you know, if you, and sometimes, you know, you get an invitation. Sometimes you actually have to just go and take a risk and go places. I mean, I think what happened after that is I got a sort of opportunity to be part of a group show in China. And rather than just sending the work, I thought, you know, I'm going to go as well, because it'll be interesting. I'll learn about it. And the very nature of me going, meeting everyone, like, da-da-da, opened so many doors just by being there. And also I just could see the energy. I could see the response was different. In terms of, I could see that somehow the chemistry of connection was powerful, and I felt actually there's so much opportunity to do things. And I also, the beauty of China at that point was 2017, 2018, was the building so many private museums.
Where were you in China?
I think I got my first group show was at the Power Long Museum.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
And in Shanghai.
Yeah, in Shanghai, which is an amazing, huge, you know, private museum. And I was like going around the space, which was gigantic, the size of Tate Modern.
Huge.
And I was going around the size of this massive museum. And I was like, wow, this is insane. As a young artist, to be able to put works in a huge museum like this and have like 5,000 people come to the opening. And like, and I was wearing one of my Fred Egg suits, and I was absolutely mobbed by people, because I was
they
lobster cap.
They all wanted to take pictures with me.
Yeah,
you,
I had
right?
lobster cap, a Fred Egg suit. And I think I also had my lobster costume guy with me.
Oh, so
I had like a person dressed up in the lobster costume hang out with me. So the lobster character in a way was also in the room. It was like being at a rock concert or something. It was like people were so enthusiastic. And so it just really opened my eyes. And I was like, wow, there's huge opportunity here to actually, if you've got ideas and big ideas, there's huge spaces, huge galleries that are actually really interested in doing things. So it just sort of happened that from that, then it was just like a domino effect of more and more museums and galleries in Asia, you know, gave me the opportunity to do exhibitions. And then that just kept evolving, really, with more collaborations. I did the Adidas collaboration with Adidas with a range of footwear and apparel and stuff, and that was across all Asian countries. And that, you know, so just I think these different projects, and obviously just K-pop stars buying my work and these type of things just all helped build this. And then Korea was quite important.
I think you are one of the international artists who is really loved by the K-pop stars.
Yeah, like it was great. I did my first show in Korea in 2019. And that was crazy because, again, it's similarly talking about the connection in China, like in Korea, like it just felt for some reason the lobster character just really connected with people.
Yeah.
And you know, very quickly that went pretty crazy in Korea. Like from my first exhibition there, I mean, you know, it's a huge waiting list for works. And then when I had a museum show after that, it just went quite crazy.
So when is your next show in Asia?
So in September, I have the project with Lotte for Freeze and K11, you know,
Yes, I remember the K11 one.
We're putting like a giant lobster on the lake in Korea, which is quite cool because it's been a project I've wanted to do for a long time. It's put an inflatable on the water, but it's quite an expensive procedure. So very happy that Lotte have been
passionate. At least they're sponsored. They're paying for it, right? Congratulations. Yeah. That's great because I think your project has to be really big.
I think so. It's like pushing fantasy and reality. And also I think with that project also great because in addition to that, we're also doing a whole sculpture show in the park around it and
that's
merchandise
amazing.
And lots of things.
That's
so
great.
It should really, and lots of digital art and all the screens around City Center of Seoul. So it should be a great way of like bringing art to a lot of people, which
like
is exciting.
Like invasion.
Yes.
I remember you told me that once you bought a robot and then they built it for you with the cross and everything. And then even if you're not there, you can speak to the audience, right?
Yeah, so basically during the pandemic, I'd been offered this whole takeover of the Saatchi Gallery, the whole ground floor, all the four galleries, which is huge space and a great slot for a big scale UK exhibition. So I was, you know, I had this slot, but then it was during the pandemic, which was a crazy time, and doing a public exhibition seemed super problematic.
Yeah,
first of all, because at any moment a lockdown could have been called. So I was like thinking about this impossibility of an exhibition in such a crazy time, and I was like, it sort of made me feel that the exhibition was like the Titanic at the bottom of the sea because you couldn't really get there, but you could send cameras into it. So I sort of thought, well, actually, it could be a really interesting dimension to explore. So I looked into telepresence robotics. I became obsessed with telepresence robotics, and I later actually made a fully functioning art-making robot. But at this point, I was like, I was very interested in telepresence, the idea of, aside, you know, the metaverse you explore in a digital dimension, but I was very interested in creating an avatar that you could explore the real world in. So like another robotic self in the real world with action and agency. And anyway, so I looked into find a company, Double Robotics, who were able to make me a special telepresent robot with movable claws. You know, so it was basically like iPads on sticks, like Giacometti iPads.
Do you put a mask
on the face? Yes, luckily no mask required. But what
no mask.
What was amazing about it was basically that, so I managed to get the maximum amount of these robots I could. I think it was like 20 or 25.
Wow.
With claws. And then we had, so there were like special lobster telepresent robots. And so it was like FaceTime, but you were in control of yourself as well.
How
so
wonderful.
You could go around, right? You could control yourself around the gallery and chat to people. So it was actually pretty amazing. So there was a great artist friend of mine, Dougie Fields, and he couldn't make the show because of COVID. So, you know, him and I, like, I gave him a tour of the exhibition just as a robot, and he's very funny looking. He had amazing stuff. So it was just like really, so it felt like we were both, that was the great thing about it. If you went on a tour with someone, you felt like you were both there.
Oh, how wonderful.
So
I
it
love
was a real, it. It was a real, like, trip because, you'd have this random things like bumping into people and random things that happen in real life, you know, which is so cool that in a way it happened to the robotic self.
This is such a sci-fi movie.
So I did the world's first art opening for robots, for the pandemic.
Oh,
and very lucky because, for example, it turned out that the day after my opening was going to be a lockdown. So if I'd had a normal exhibition, it would have been game over, a complete waste of time, completely panned.
Yeah.
But luckily, because I'd anchored the whole exhibition around robots, I was able to have my press view.
I love
and
it.
I, and I had like every TV channel in there filming
of course.
Because it was actually something that was
such
relevant.
A good media. I mean,
and what was great is we ran, and this because it was all quite complicated to pull it off, but we ran a very scheduled tours of you book a robot for the exhibition, so people could log in online, book a robot, and go around the show during lockdown. And what was amazing is like I would sometimes pop in to see how things were, the robots were getting on, and there'd be like a whole school class from some other part of the country, all logging in like on on the robots.
Yeah.
And you know, like it was just really cool that in a way,
such a cool presentation.
Yeah, it really felt like, it's hard to explain, but changing the activity in the gallery changes the gallery.
Yeah, of course,
like
it
changes everything in a weird way, because it felt like another dimension.
Hey, talking about this, let's talk about what I want to take your thinking about today's museum, right? Many museums has been rejecting popular artists like yourself, but we see that now many of these private museums or museums who doesn't have enough fundings, they are pushed to open, to invite all the popular artists because you guys sell tickets, right?
Yeah.
How are you thinking about it? What are you thinking about it?
Well, I think, you know, there's different museums have different strategies and stuff. And like, you know, some museums have a certain type of thing they want to show and others. I'm pretty open. I don't get in any way upset about museums. No. Not, you know, because I think there's a lot of museums out there in the world. And, you know, I recently had a show at one of my favorite museums in the world, which is the Archaeological Museum of Naples, which I think is the most beautiful. So for me, that was like a total dream. I felt like no way deserved to show my favorite museum in the world with masterpieces of antiquity. And so in a way, like, there's so many possibilities of cool exhibitions.
Because
so
a recent experience we have is one of the museum was showing one of my artists, and immediately it increased the traffic of younger generation, because the Gen Z or the younger children, really today they have no time even to read everything, to start looking at conceptual art. But your sort of painting, sculptures really entice them. They could have a dialogue with them.
Yeah.
And so it immediately brought another group of visitors to the museum, which I think is fantastic.
Well, I think that's great, definitely. And I think that, you know, I think ultimately museums culturally, you know, obviously serve important academic function or cultural function in terms of like exploring as the concepts and ideas, important societal ideas, but also they have a function as you know, as a place for families and you know, to go and like, you know, learn and explore culture and everything. And I think that accessibility and inclusivity is very important. And I think, like, I like to think within my work, like, that's very much at the forefront of this idea of democratic accessibility and like being something that a whole family can come to one of my exhibitions. Like, if the kids love my work, I'm super happy, because that's like
the kids definitely will love your work. Come on.
Yeah, I've got two kids myself.
Yeah.
And their kids.
And what do they think? What do your children think when they see your work?
Well, art is so natural to kids. They live in a world of art. You know, they've got their kids at a young age.
Do they want the lobster to be in their bed?
Yeah, well, they have many. They've managed to sneak from my studio lots of love. They were actually distributing them at school.
I love it. They can sell it.
Yeah, they were trading them at school.
I love it.
They actually distributed so many at school that basically every single... The teachers were all like having a lobster crackdown.
They
were like banning lobsters from the playground. But it was very sweet. Like
the trading.
No, but you can learn a lot from kids, because it's amazing to see. I find it very interesting to see, you know, when kids grow up and the things they see and the symbols that have meaning and the things that they are inspired by. It's a very interesting reflection on our society and what we're seeing, you know. And I think, and also I just think it's very refreshing, because kids have a freedom to things also, which sometimes people can lose a little bit. So Yeah.
It's interesting to see kids how and how they evolved anyway, and being inspired by your work. They grew up with the lobster, and I love the way that they're using lobsters for trading. And on this note, thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Pearl, for coming.
Thank you. Thank
Always
you for
a treat to have you.
Showing us all your wonderful student and sharing with the audience.
Of course, my pleasure.
Thank you, Philip.